Thanks. So first of all, thanks to the organizers for inviting me, and thanks to everyone who's given excellent talks so far. I've really been enjoying the conference. And today I'm going to tell you about work which is described in this paper, currently out on the archive, in collaboration with Chris Heinrich, Lukas Witkowski, and Mike Levin. And since I'm the first person talking about symmetry-enriched topological order, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to review what that means. So obviously, we're all familiar with the concept of topological order. And here I'm using C to represent some, bunch of mathematical rules that tell us how anions braid and fuse with each other. And the sort of name of the game for symmetry-enriched topological phases is, suppose that I start with one topological order, okay? And I'm going to add some global symmetry. Here I'm calling it G. And it turns out that depending on how this global symmetry acts on the anions in your theory, you can have multiple distinct phases with the same topological order and the same unbroken symmetry, which are nonetheless necessarily separated by a phase transition unless you break this symmetry. So an example is the topological order I'm going to be talking about most in this talk is the topological order of the toric code. And I think probably most of you are very familiar with this, but let me just review. If you are not familiar with this, the kind of heuristic picture to have in your head is that this is the topological order of an S-wave superconductor. So there are three anions. Psi here is a fermion, and I say fermionic charge because you can think of it as basically being a BdG quasiparticle. M here, topologically, is the pi vortex of the superconductor. And E is simply the bound state of the two, okay, which again has a non-trivial Z2 charge and is a boson. So, okay, so this is a topological order. And suppose that I want to also have time reversal symmetry as a good symmetry of my system. So perhaps the most natural choice for time reversal symmetry is to say, well, E and M are both bosons, so let's choose T squared as plus 1, acting on both E and M, and that's a fine choice. However, you could also choose T squared is equal to minus 1, acting on either E or M. And that's also a fine choice, because these are, remember, these are emergent bosons, okay? So it's a bosonic system. T squared has to be plus 1 for the whole system, for the system as a whole, but these E's have to come in pairs, so this is actually not a problem, okay? So we add time reversal symmetry, and we have, at least these two phases. So these symmetry-enriched phases give us a finer classification of topologically ordered phases with symmetry. Okay, so in order to kind of get a bit of a broad brush picture of this finer classification of phases, we need to think a little bit more about how symmetries can act on anions. Now, the first way that this can happen is I can have a system of anions, and I can add to it some global symmetry. And then that global symmetry, the anions can carry fractional charges of that global symmetry. This is what we call symmetry fractionalization. Okay? And this is by far the most familiar example of symmetry enrichment. It's what you've probably heard about if you've thought about spin liquid phases a bunch. And in fact, it's probably most familiar from the fractional quantum Hall effect. So if you think about a Laughlin state has quasiparticles, which are topologically anions. They have non-trivial braiding statistics. They also happen to carry fractional electromagnetic charge. Okay. And similarly, this example that I gave you with the toric code, if I happen to choose T squared is minus 1 acting on a boson, you can think of that as having a fractional charge under time reversal symmetry. Okay. So one thing I can do is simply add, if you like, a global symmetry, such as U1 charge conservation or time reversal, to my theory of anions. And write down some rules for how those anions transform under the symmetry, and that can give me some SET phases. However, there is a second way to get SET phases, in which the symmetry is essentially an intrinsic part of the topological order itself. So for example, in this case, the symmetry, we call these anion permutation symmetries because they actually act to exchange or permute anions in your theory. Okay? And so the example that I'm going to focus on today is a symmetry of this toric code topological order, which interchanges the E and M bosons. Okay, so what do I mean when I say, this is kind of a symmetry at the level of the topological order? Well, this topological order contains some topological data, okay? And among other things, that data tells us about the cell statistics of all of these anions. So it tells us that E and M are bosons with respect to themselves. Psi is a fermion. And it also tells us about mutual statistics. So it says that if you take any one of these guys, so what this matrix represents is if you take, you know, this component, oops, sorry. This component here, you know, says if I take an E all the way around another E, I do a double exchange, I get a plus one. Okay. And this here tells me that if I take, you know, an E all the way around an M, that's like taking, you know, a charge around a pi vortex, and I get a phase of minus one. Okay. And so what we mean when we say this is a symmetry at the level of the topological order is that this data, you can see here, these guys are both bosons. And also this, you know, matrix is invariant if I interchange simultaneously the first two rows and the first two columns. And at a more technical level, there's other data that I'm sure some of you are very familiar with, such as, you know, F symbols and R symbols, and all of these guys have to be invariant under the up to a gauge transformation under the symmetry. Okay. So that's what we mean by an anion permuting symmetry. Okay. Now, it's very natural to assume that, you know, when this symmetry exists at the level of the topological order, and it doesn't have any obvious inconsistencies, and I won't say too much about what I mean by that, that it should also be, you know, something that you can realize in a two-dimensional Hamiltonian phase. And there's sort of a rule of thumb for these two-dimensional, you know, gapped topological or SET or SPT phases, which is that you expect that anything that doesn't have a chiral edge mode can be realized on a lattice by means of like a commuting projector Hamiltonian. Okay. So we expect that, you know, if this really is a fine phase of a Hamiltonian system in 2D, that we should actually be able to construct an exactly solvable lattice model or a commuting projector lattice model that realizes it as its ground state. So here's the puzzle. So this is a honeycomb lattice version of the original commuting projector model, which realizes the toric code topological order that Alexei Kataev wrote down. So the Hilbert space consists of Ising spins on each link, and the Hamiltonian has two parts, one of which says that, you know, in the X basis, it doesn't really matter, you can choose X or Z, but that in this basis, an even number of down spins meet at each vertex. So these down spins in the X direction form closed loops. Anytime you're in the ground state. And then there's another term which simply flips all the spins around each plaquette. So you can ask, okay, here's a commuting projector model for this topological order, which we know, you know, the topological order has this symmetry. Is this symmetry manifest in this case? And the answer is no. And the reason for that is that you have to ask, well, you know, in this model, who is E and who is M? And I have two types of terms. And it's, you know, what is usually called the E boson is a violation of this first term. So it lives, for example, at vertices where I have, you know, three or one edges coming in with spin down. The M, on the other hand, is a violation of this second term. Okay, so it lives on plaquettes where when you flip the spins, you get the wrong phase. So clearly, there is no, you know, in this case, certainly there's no on-site symmetry that exchanges E and M. And in fact, if I wanted to exchange them, I would actually have to, you know, perform a duality transformation, take the lattice to the dual lattice. So it's sort of there, but it's not on site. And there's another way of writing the toric code, which was due to Xiaogang Wen, in which the symmetry is a little bit, you don't have to dualize the lattice, but it's still not an on site symmetry. Okay, it's related to lattice translations. So it's kind of puzzling. You know, we thought really there should be a way to write down a model in which this symmetry is manifest and on site, unless there's some, you know, subtle reason that you can't do this. So what we set out to do was construct a commuting projector Hamiltonian in which this symmetry is there in an on-site way. And I want to emphasize, you know, the main reason that you would want to do this is to really convince yourself that there is nothing wrong with having it present in an on-site manner. So that's what I'm going to talk about for the main subject of this talk. And this is basically just a guide to what I'm going to tell you. So I'm going to start by telling you about, I'm going to start with a lattice model which actually realizes not the toric code topological order, but a larger, if you like, topological order, one that has more anions, which corresponds to what you get when you gauge this anion permuting symmetry. Okay, and then, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about this, and then we're going to talk about how you can ungauge, and I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by that presently. how we can ungauge this anion permuting symmetry to actually obtain in such a way that we obtain the Torah code with an explicit, you know, on-site symmetry. And hopefully at the end of the talk, you'll understand a little bit more about what these two pictures represent. Oh yeah, and I should mention that there is another kind of perspective on how to do this also appeared around the same time that we posted our paper. Okay, so the last time I gave this talk, the joke in this slide was very not explicit, so I tried to make it a little bit more explicit in the hopes that some people would appreciate it. But anyway, in anion permuting symmetries, what I want to start by telling you about is the gauge theory that I'm going to work with to get this model. Okay. Now, there are actually two choices for this gauge theory. The one that I'm going to use at a technical level is what we call the doubled Ising topological order. Now, okay, so first of all, what is the Ising topological order? Well, it has two non-trivial anions, a fermion, which I'm going to call psi, and it's going to be blue, and this other guy here, which I'm going to call sigma, and it's going to be red. And, you know, basically, again, at a kind of heuristic level, if you're not familiar with this, you can think of psi as being like a BDG quasiparticle in a chiral P-wave superconductor, and sigma as being like this vortex with its Majorana zero mode. And in that case, this Ising cross Ising bar, this doubled Ising topological order, simply consists of two layers of chiral P-wave superconductor with opposite chirality. Okay. So again, the rule is if you can make it on the lattice, you can't have chiral edge modes. But so here I have opposite chirality in the top and bottom layer, and so that's fine. I can actually, we'll see in a minute, that we can actually do this in a solvable lattice model. And now you might ask, okay, so just in the kind of heuristic superconducting picture, what does it mean that, you know, I can get, so if this is a gauge version of this, basically there should be some kind of phase transition in which I, you know, if you like, condense something that takes me from here to here, and we said here is basically the topological order of the ordinary S-wave superconductor. So what should I do? Well, what I can do is I can take a pair of these fermions. Remember, over here there's a BDG quasiparticle. These layers don't talk to each other. There's a BDG quasiparticle in the top layer and a BDG quasiparticle in the bottom layer. So I can pair these guys and Bose condense that object. Okay. I'm calling it an interior Cooper pair. It's not really, you know, they're kind of bound together in space, but so how does this get us to the S-wave superconductor? Well, the first observation is once these guys are condensed, if I try to make a vortex either only in the top layer or only in the bottom layer, and I bring this boson around it, okay, the fermion in the bottom layer does not, you know, in this topological theory, does not see this vortex at all. Okay, so when I bring this object around here, I get a baryphase of pi. That means that trying to put a vortex only in the top layer or only in the bottom layer actually creates branch cuts in this condensate. So these guys have to be confined. Okay? So that's the first thing. I lose these single layer vortices. The second thing is, you know, obviously, once these guys are paired, there's only one fermion because, you know, it's no longer the case that a BDG quasiparticle up here is distinct in any way from a BDG quasiparticle down here. Okay? And the final thing, So now you might ask, okay, so we have our psi, and we got rid of some excitations. And then you might ask, well, you know, where are E and M? And the answer is that, so a vortex in one layer is confined. But if I take a pair of vortices, one in the top layer and one in the bottom layer, this object is not confined. This is still a legitimate sort of point-like particle. This guy in the Ising topological order corresponds to sigma times sigma bar. Okay. And the important thing is that, you know, basically, if you like, this is two vortices of chiral P-wave superconductors. Each of these guys has a Majorana zero mode. And so there are actually two internal states here. This object can have even or odd fermion parity. And so it's natural to associate one of those states with the vortex of the S-wave superconductor, which we call M, and one with the bound state, obviously, of the fermion in the vortex, which is what I was calling E. OK. Good. So there's a relationship. I can Bose condense these interlayer pairs of fermions and get from this doubled Ising topological order to the Torah code topological order. This is what I'm claiming. And I'll tell you in a minute how to do it on a lattice. There's one crucial observation about this, which is, so a single layer vortex becomes confined. Okay, and you might ask, you know, what is this transition? We sort of said that this transition had something to do with gauging a symmetry which exchanges E and M. And one way to see that in this kind of cartoon picture is, suppose that I start with one of these objects. This is this sigma sigma bar guy, okay, the bilayer vortex. And imagine that I made one of these confined, you know, defects in the top layer. And now I'm going to take this guy, you know, in between these two, okay? And so when you do this, and this is perhaps most obvious just by thinking about what happens before these guys are confined, okay? So first of all, when I do this, this bottom guy doesn't see anything, right? Okay. But this top guy, what it does is it's going now around through the pair, and this is essentially the, you know, the same as braiding these vortices in your chiral p-wave superconductor. So what happens is that if these guys both, if these pairs both started off with even fermion parity, they now both have odd fermion parity. And so if I run this again, okay, so now imagine that I'm, you know, this is a confined defect, but basically what you see is that when this object goes around, you know, through, crosses the branch cut between these guys, that it comes back, it starts as an M and it comes back as an E, okay? So one way to understand that there's a relationship between this sort of transition in which these guys become confined and the symmetry which permutes CNM is that you see that these guys become what we call symmetry fluxes. Okay, so going around them, they're confined when the symmetry is global, they're deconfined when the symmetry is gauged, and going around them interchanges this these ENM. So acts on the anions in the theory by the Z2 exchange symmetry. Okay, there we go. Okay, good. So this was a sort of cartoon version. So now let me tell you a little bit about how we do this on the lattice, and in particular how on the lattice we can do this in two different ways, one of which will realize the ordinary toric code, and one of which will realize a toric code in which this symmetry is manifest. So the first thing that we need to know is how do we actually make this Ising times Ising bar topological order on the lattice? And what we can use is a Levin-Wen model, so a string net type construction. And the details of this are not important. All you need to know is, first of all, the Hilbert space consists of labels for the edges in the lattice, and there are three possible labels, which we'll call 1, psi, and sigma. Okay, and again, psi 1 is black, psi is blue, sigma is red. And we'll see why we have this labeling convention in a minute. Okay, and then just like, so the Hamiltonian is very similar in spirit to the toric code. It consists of two terms. I have a term at each vertex and a term at each plaquette. Okay, and this plaquette term you can basically think of as some kind of kinetic action on these edges. And for our purposes, it's important to note that this vertex term imposes on the ground state the constraint that these sigma edges form closed loops. Okay, so I do have a vertex at which I can have an odd number of blues, but I can only have an even number of reds. So the one other thing that we need to know about this model, and I'm not going to explain this in detail, but we need to understand what it means to have an open. Okay, so I said that these are the vertices that are energetically allowed. So if I have an odd number of red edges, that is necessarily some excitation. Okay, so an open sort of string with two endpoints of red edges creates a pair of excitations, and it turns out that those excitations correspond, depending on the details of how you make this string, either to the sigma, okay, so the vortex in the top layer, or the sigma bar, okay. So from our previous discussion, just, you know, about this kind of heuristic picture of superconductors, we know that as we go across this transition, we expect these defects to become confined. So the obvious way to confine them is simply to assign an energetic penalty for every edge that carries the sigma label, okay. So I just penalize all red edges. Okay, I can add such a term to the Hamiltonian. I make this term very large. I go through some second order phase transition. And on the other side, in the extreme limit, there are no red edges at all in my theory. And this is my vertex condition. And the plaquette term simply interchanges blue and black edges. And you wind up basically, with the toric code. Okay. Good. So this is one way to do this. But we said that the ordinary, this would be, you know, the Hamiltonian that you would get, the effective low energy theory, as J goes to infinity, is exactly Kataev's toric code written, in this case, on the honeycomb lattice. So this obviously does not preserve the Z2 symmetry in any kind of on-site way. So in order to do that, we're going to essentially drive this same transition, but we're going to do it in a slightly different way. And what we're going to do is we're going to add a spin degree of freedom to the center of each plaquette, okay, an Ising spin. And now, instead of saying red edges are bad, what we're going to say is that the red edges are energetically confined to sit at domain walls between Ising spins with different orientations. So, you know, this is okay, a red edge on a domain wall, or a black or blue edge on a non-domain wall, okay? And these are all configurations that cost energy, right? So if I put a blue or black edge on a domain wall or a red edge between two spins of the same orientation. So my claim is, if I do this, I actually explicitly preserve the Z2 symmetry. But the first thing I better explain before we talk about that is, if I do this, I actually kill this double Ising topological order and arrive at a phase whose topological order is that of the toric code. And I'm not going to go through the details, but the kind of essential point here is that, so it is true that if I put these plaquette spins in a paramagnetic phase, right, I do have a ground state which has proliferated sigma loops. Okay, but now if I try to make an open string, so if I actually try to make this sigma vortex, okay, either the sigma or the sigma bar, I have to make an open string of sigma edges, and this necessarily cannot live on a domain wall. Okay, so these guys, these excitations are nonetheless confined. Okay, because basically every edge, every red edge which is not on a domain wall, costs a finite energy, and as I pull them further apart, that energy cost goes up. Okay, good. So these guys are confined, and you can also convince yourself that there's only one fermion in this theory, okay? And it turns out that you get the topological order of the toric code. So what about the symmetry? So to understand that this way of, if you like, getting to the toric code topological order on the lattice has this anion permuting symmetry in an explicit way, let's begin by looking at some operators, okay, which create excitations within a given domain. So in this picture here, I've drawn it with all of the edges black, but they, you know, they could all be black or blue, but none of the edges in this picture are red, okay? And now so in the same way that, you know, to create a sigma defect, I needed a string which basically created a string of these red edges, to create the sigma-sigma bar defect, there are also, you know, operators acting on the lattice such that I create some kind of defect at each endpoint. And it turns out that this sigma-sigma bar defect is associated within a given domain, if I don't cross any red edges, with two different string types. Okay? One of those string types, I got ahead of myself. Let me remind you of the string operators in the toric code. So in the toric code, the operator that creates an E boson just flips the spins along a bunch of edges. And the operator that creates an M boson basically measures the spins on a bunch of edges that it creates. Okay. So now here I am in a given domain. There's no sigma edges around here. And the sigma sigma bar string has two, okay, the operator that creates sigma sigma bar defects actually has sort of two types. It comes in two flavors, one of which interchanges, goes along a bunch of edges, and it just interchanges one and psi edges. Okay. And the other of which, if you like, measures whether or not there's a psi fermion on each edge that it crosses. Okay. And you expect that there are two types because remember that, you know, basically there are essentially within a given domain, right, there's this defect either has fermion parity even or fermion parity odd. Okay. So in a given domain, we get these two, this guy actually gives us two, you know, essentially distinct particle types. So now we want to ask, well, what happens if I cross into a different domain? And you can argue for what has to happen in that case just by remembering what happens, you know, if I actually made a, you know, an open line of these guys, if I made a pair of these confined defects. And remember that if I make a pair of these confined defects, so this was the continuum picture, But and I you know, so here I'm going to start. There's some quasi-particle who comes in, who comes up to this line, and this guy is an M. Okay, and we argued just from basically the braiding rules of the TQFT that kind of that what has to happen as this guy goes around, right, is that so my M has now gone around here, and it has to come back as an E. Okay. So this is what we know happens when we have these confined open sigma strings. But the crucial point is that actually the action of the actual operators which create these defects, okay, in the lattice is local. So basically my operator, which is moving this anion string, knows that it has crossed this edge. But it cannot know that whether this is an open string or a closed string. Okay? It can't know whether it's going to cross it an even or odd number of times before coming back to the same place. So therefore, basically, whether this domain wall is open or closed, when I cross it, I have to change from an E into an M. Okay? This is kind of guaranteed by the fact that these guys are symmetry fluxes, if you will. Okay. So that means that really the two types of quasi-particles, the two types of anions that we should think of in this symmetric model are, we can call them E and M, but E basically corresponds to the operator which interchanges one edges with psi edges in regions where the Plaquette spins point up, okay, and which measures, whether each edge it crosses has a psi label or not in regions where the Plaquette spins are down, okay, and M is just the opposite, okay. And the key point about this, and you can check, by the way, that these guys have the right mutual statistics to be called E and M. Okay? But the important thing is that you'll notice that if I now flip all of the Plaquette spins, right? So I'm in a paramagnetic phase, I can just flip all of the Plaquette spins, that preserves the domain walls as the symmetry of the theory, that I also necessarily interchange who is E and who is M. Good. So this is a model, specifically for the Torah code, in which this symmetry is explicitly realized. And in the last kind of couple minutes, I just wanted to talk a little bit about maybe generalizations of this. So what do we learn? So it turns out that this construction is actually very general. So anytime that you have a topological order which does not have chiral edge modes, okay, that's sort of a necessary ingredient, and where the gauged version does not have chiral edge modes, basically, provided that the gauged version of this anion permuting symmetry exists, you can always make this kind of construction. And that's what you expect. So if the gauged version doesn't exist, then the symmetry is definitely sick or what we call anomalous in some way. And so this shows that you can actually realize any symmetry that you would sort of expect to be mathematically consistent in such a commuting projector Hamiltonian. And another sort of amusing corollary of this is you can ask, well, how can we find other examples? So this example of this anion permuting symmetry in the Torah code has actually been known for a long time. But using this construction and using what we know about how to sort of get between some phases on the lattice and some smaller phases on the lattice, you can actually construct a bunch of other examples of models with anion permuting symmetries. So one amusing example is you could start with a topological order that is doubled SU3 level 3, and you can condense it to get the quantum double of the gauge theory of A4, and this also has an anion permuting symmetry in it. So that's basically what I wanted to say. Maybe just to take a step back, hopefully I have convinced you that although they are not familiar from experimentally known examples, that these anion permuting symmetries describe an interesting class of symmetry-enriched topological phases, which at least theoretically are, I think, worthy of study. And although, if you take a topological order which has an anion permuting symmetry and write down the simplest commuting projector model, say 11-1 string net model for that phase, in general, the symmetry is not realized in an on-site way. You can always, by starting with a more complicated commuting projector model for the gauge theory, basically you can always construct a model which realizes this symmetry explicitly as an on-site symmetry of the system. Thanks.
I'm not sure I understood very well, but is this some analog, the case you did, of an electromagnetic symmetry for a Z2 gauge theory, this one that exchanges E and M?
Correct, yeah, so that's right. So in the original toric code, which is exactly Z2 gauge theory, the symmetry is there, but it involves an actual lattice to do a lattice transformation, and that is electromagnetic duality.
Right, so in field theory, the analog would be in four dimensions, say, for U1 gauge theory. There's a dual theory, which is also U1 gauge theory, and if you want to make it manifest, you could do a theory that has two U1 gauge fields, but you'd have to put in a self-duality condition to get the same theory. And so is that what you're doing? Is you're considering, in a sense, two Z mod 2 gauge theories, but maybe without the self-duality. I mean, if we wanted to get the original theory, we would put a self-duality condition, and maybe you're getting a kind of double theory without it. I'm not sure.
I guess the thing is that the doubled Ising topological order is not, it's not two copies of the Z2 gauge theory. It has some, it's, in some ways it's similar, but in particular, so Z2, sorry? Oh yeah, because I mean, so Z2 gauge theory has, you know, two copies of Z2 gauge theory. Everybody would be abelian, and this sigma guy is not abelian, and I'm not sure whether that's something that, in your way of kind of imposing a duality condition, would come out naturally or not.
Well, if you impose self-duality, you're getting equivalent theory, I would say, so you'd be back to the abelian theory. If you don't, I'm not sure.
So maybe it's a, yeah. I'm curious to know why you say it's not, why electromagnetic duality in 3+1 is not a it's anomalous.
I think the question may be whether the electric charge and the magnetic charge are the same mass, for example, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A physical symmetry that relates the two, not a duality that tells you can re-describe the same physics in a different
sort of
way.
Right. Okay, I see. Yeah.
So what is the reasoning that cannot exchange primary physical symmetry?
I think that's the surface of some 4+1D topological phase.
Yes, so maybe following up on that sort of feeling a bit, we should, so you have this paramagnetic state that's sort of underlying the whole thing, you have these domain walls between
Correct.
The two.
Yeah.
But if you stop these spins from fluctuating, you just have individual domains, each of which just looks like normal toric code, but then you have domain walls where you have some strange gluing condition that corresponds to
Yes,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you sum overall configuration, this would be like the self-duality condition, maybe.
The tensor network description of toric code topological order treats the E and the M particles very differently. It's really suited for the usual toric code,
right.
And maybe not so much for the symmetric toric code. Do you guys know how that plays out?
It's not something that, certainly not something that I have thought about in detail, but in principle, you, for all of these string net models, you can write down a tensor network kind of solution. And my expectation would be that you could work from that. You know, you could probably add in these Plaquette spins, and so certainly I would expect that it does have an exact representation as a tensor network ground state. Whether that's related in an obvious way to that of the toric code is less clear, I would say.
Can you remind us what D of A4 is?
Oh, the gauged.
Yeah.
What do you want to know about it? Like
is it
A4? Is that Carnot?
It's the alternating group of four elements. And it has, so in particular, let me tell you what I think is interesting about this. So I have, you know, SE3 level 3 has a Z3, you know, boson that you could in principle condense. So if you condense the pairs of that Z3 boson in this copy and that Z3 boson in that copy, so it turns out that there's in this theory here, there's one particle that splits into three, okay? And if you like this, that implies that this guy has a Z3 anion permuting symmetry. So there's one anion in here, which gives rise to three different anions in here, which have this Z3 permutation symmetry. I don't know if it's enlightening to kind of write out all the elements, but that's the kind of key point about this example. And in fact, there are other, you know, you can use doubled SU, you know, doubled SUN level N, for example, to construct other examples where you can obtain more interesting anion permuting, new anion permuting symmetries, like ZN type things.
There's a much more elementary example of that. If you just take SU2 and you convert it to SO3, then the J equals K over 4 appears twice, and there's a Z2 symmetry between them. Is that the same thing? Or because that looks, your example looks much more complicated.
So, all of the ones that I know of that you can construct from SU2 have their anion exchange symmetry. So it's a Z2 symmetry. This guy is a Z3 symmetry. So I think it's different.
Well, it started with Z3.
Yeah, but maybe I didn't understand your question.
What's special about this example as opposed to the more elementary examples?
I don't know that it's special. I just wanted to emphasize the point that you can construct, you know, examples in which the symmetry is not Z2, but like Z3, Z4, so on. That's the only reason that I put this one up and not some, you know, SU2 level K-based example.
I think there's a similar example if you go to SU3, I forget what level, 9 or something. If you go to higher level, you can also get a Z3. You don't need to have...
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but I think multiples of 3 do this, basically, when the level of SU3 is a multiple of 3.
So in the C2 gauge theory, you can, there's the state which is the 3 fermion state.
Yes.
I guess you could make a double of that.
Double 3 fermion? Could.
Do you have a Z3 symmetry that permutes the fermions? Is that this example? Or is that, maybe it's hard to just off the...
You know what? I actually, off the top of my head, I don't remember. Okay. There is one which is related to SE3, which gives you that. And I believe. I mean, I think it might be this one, but actually, no. I don't think it's exactly this one. But
I had a different question. Actually, this model presumably has edge states, or at least the symmetry enriched topological order should have gapless edge states.
Right.
Because you can't condense either the E or M particle. What happens? Have you examined the edge of this model?
Yes, actually. So when you... Okay, so the observation is... Well, the picture doesn't matter. But the string net model for the gauge theory has, you know, a natural gapped edge, right? Which you can think of as having condensed this sigma sigma bar guy. But if you take that gapped edge and kind of have your theory with global symmetry inherit it, then you can convince yourself that that edge actually breaks the symmetry. And so that's the way that these commuting projector models resolve it. Although, so that means that, you know, there's presumably something you can do to the edge which would not be commuting projector, which would give you this gapless thing.